Thanks. It's a lot of fun to be here, obviously. It's a little bit weird actually giving a talk in a classroom since I do my regular job in classrooms, but I'll try to do things a little bit differently. First of all, thanks so much to Veronica and the J.B. Moore Society for inviting me. You guys put on a lot of great programs, and I'm honored to be included in them. And first off, I guess the required disclaimer, especially since my DOD handlers are here to watch. Although I am a reservist, and this talk is related to work that I do for the Army. I'm clearly wearing my professor costume today. These are my own comments. The DOD knows better than to have somebody like me speak for them. They don't represent those of the JAG School, the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School, the Judge Advocate General, the Army, or the Department of Defense. So it's just me. This actually relates pretty closely to the work that I do for the Army, much more so than the work that I do in my civilian capacity here, although I have written as a civilian on rule of law issues before. For the Army, I edit this book. It's a handbook on rule of law operations, rule of law projects. It's designed for judge advocates, Army lawyers, who deploy in support of these operations. And I'll talk a little bit about how judge advocates get involved in these operations and why we need to have a handbook for them. There's not an awful lot of law here. Unfortunately, the rule of law problem is primarily an operational problem more than it is a problem having to do with law itself. It's a problem about how to get law working in certain environments. It's unsurprising, right? Lawyers are ill-trained for that task, and it's not quite as directly related to what we usually do here at the law school. My talk's limited really to the rule of law in establishing the rule of law in the context of military operations. So there are a lot of programs out there, development programs, that are designed for environments in developing countries, for instance, places that are where the government may be unstable, but it's not actually the site of a military conflict. My work really is focused entirely on cases in which there is an ongoing military conflict, and we're trying to establish the rule of law at the same time. Everybody wants to talk about, everybody starts with sort of what the rule of law is. And unfortunately, it's the first of many points of confusion, I think. Because there are sort of two different things. People will say, well, we need to do some rule of law here, right? So there's the mission of rule of law. And in the context of a military campaign, the point is to leave in place a functioning civil authority. It simply is untenable, I think largely these days as a moral, but certainly as an international political matter, to intervene in a country forcefully, militarily, and simply, blow up the other nation's military and leave. That's just not going to happen. You can imagine that circumstance, but it simply is untenable, I think. The international community wouldn't support it, and for good reason, I don't think we would want to do it. So nobody is going to just go in and blow stuff and pull out. That's just not going to happen anymore. And so a big part of the rule of law mission is to make sure that we actually can leave, redeploy. Specifically with regard to counterinsurgency, though, right, the types of conflicts that we're fighting right now in Iraq and Afghanistan, rule of law really is key to the successful conclusion of a counterinsurgency. The point of a counterinsurgency is not to smash the opponent's military and make it impossible for them to carry on the fight. It's to leave in place a legitimate government, right? So victory in a counterinsurgency is achieved, right, when the populace consents to government's legitimacy. You leave in place not just a government in the sense that it controls the population, but a government that is viewed as legitimate by the population. Why? Until the population views the government as being legitimate, they're going to keep fighting. Right? The insurgents will have fuel for their cause, and they will keep going, which means that rule of law sort of is an end state, or legitimacy is an end state in counterinsurgency. It's also a powerful means in a counterinsurgency, though, as well. Right? To the extent that you want the civilian population to believe in the local government, the host nation government, to the extent that they do, they're going to reduce their support for insurgents. And so legitimacy winds up working kind of both ways, as the objective and as a way to get to that objective. There's sort of the mission of rule of law, right? That's what we want to do. We need to establish it. So what is it? Well, for a long time, for the first couple years that I was doing this, there was a big argument over what the definition of rule of law was, during which I actually came to the conclusion that the definition was largely irrelevant. But we've settled on one. At least the United States government has settled on one. Secretary General of the United Nations issued a proposed definition in a report. People refer to it as the UN definition, but I think it's the Secretary General's definition. But it's largely adopted by the United States government, which is that the rule of law is a principle of governance. Right? It's a principle of governance in which these things are true, that people, institutions, entities, public and private, including the state itself, are accountable to laws that are publicly promulgated, equally enforced, independently adjudicated, and which are consistent with international human rights norms and standards. That's a little long, it's a little wordy, it's in paragraph form. Actually, one of the apologies that I should have made at the beginning is that I'm using PowerPoints, and it's impossible to go to any presentation in the Department of Defense without PowerPoints. My PowerPoints are terrible. These PowerPoints, I couldn't do these PowerPoints for any kind of presentation in DOD. You've got to have much better PowerPoints than mine. But an important part of any DOD effort, right, you got to have bullets. So we've managed to break down the rule of law into seven elements or effects, depending on who you ask and when you ask, in order to make it a little bit easier to parse it all out. And those seven elements, again, they're a little bit long, but you can sort of, you can key on important areas. The state has to monopolize the use of force. Right? If force is available as a means for resolving conflicts to anybody but the state, chances are pretty good you don't have a lot of law. Individuals need to be secure in their persons and property, so just basic personal security. The state itself is bound by law, which makes it right, a state of law as opposed to a state of individuals. You need to be able to determine the law, and it's stable enough to allow people to actually plan their affairs in accordance with law. Otherwise, if you've got law, it's not very useful. You have to have access to a justice system. And then there are some substantive components as well. So the UN definition calls upon human rights, and it's sort of impossible, I think, to establish a legal system and call it a legal system without accounting for some of the substance. To have a legal system, right, that would allow slavery, for instance, we wouldn't really even think of that as a legal system anymore. So you have to include some substantive aspect. I have to tell you, this is by far the most contentious part of the definition, or any definition. Which substantive guarantees do you include? Because there's a lot of tension here. There's real concern that these concepts of law and the way that we think about law, they're Western concepts largely. And the attempt to impose them on other people at just purely coincidentally the time when you happen to be there with a lot of guns might be problematic. And so there are a lot of concerns about importing substantive concepts into one's definition of the rule of law for this purpose. It makes it much, much harder, for instance, if you include substantive concepts. If the culture isn't prepared for those substantive concepts, you have to fight them. And that's really sort of inconsistent with the whole effort. But also, there is this possibility of cultural imperialism. Nevertheless, I think it's also, as a practical matter, impossible not to include some substance, or else you simply will not have international, or for that matter, widespread domestic support for your program. So, lots of concerns with these. Legal imperialism, as I mentioned, there's a real temptation to formalism because formalism is viewed as being somewhat easier and less imperialist. And a balancing, really, of local preferences, international norms, and above all, a desire to leave. Right, we want to get out as soon as we possibly can for a variety of reasons. And all of these things together really make the approach to establishing the rule of law different than any other development project we're likely to undertake, either in the context of military intervention or otherwise. So developing a legal system is of a piece with developing lots of other aspects of the host nation's government and economy. So installing, for instance, an electrical infrastructure, right? That's a big part of development too, but you're all lawyers, you understand law isn't quite the same as an electrical infrastructure, right? There are important values that are encoded in the legal system that just aren't present in those other types of development projects. Agricultural projects, they can have justice aspects to them, how you do them, the kinds of things that you emphasize, but there's simply no way to escape those concerns when you're doing legal projects. And then finally, the last point is this point about legitimacy, that individuals rely on the existence of justice institutions and the content of law and the conduct of their daily lives, which is to say that individuals internalize the nation's law into their own way of thinking about problems. If you don't have this sort of internal view of law, a lot of people, right, Hart would say that you don't have law at all. You just have rules and coercion. So, I think that, you know, I can't overemphasize the importance of the seventh point. It is, in fact, I think, the hardest one to get. A lot of countries never get it, or a lot of countries that we have risen and fallen without it. And of course, all of these, right, it doesn't really work as a checklist. You can't say, well, oh yes, the state monopolizes use of force, let's move on to the next one. It doesn't work that way. They're all sort of idealistic end states, and we move toward them, but it's, again, unrealistic, I think, to think that you ever achieve them. And, you know, I think most people would argue that the United States hasn't achieved a lot of these, and certainly no place that we're likely to have a major military intervention. Confusion over the mission and the principles has prompted some, I think, to refer to the mission itself not as rule of law but as security sector reform. And you'll often see a lot of documents that talk about security sector reform. I think it's a problematic concept for a lot of different reasons. That term winds up being quite slippery. For instance, the differences between the security sector and the justice sector, right, they're inherently interweaved. And so I think it's too easy to focus entirely on security and ignore some either justice or aspects of security that go beyond it. And of course, the rule of law itself goes well beyond security. Aspects of law just don't have a lot of aspects of law have very little to do with security itself. So, talk about the thing that everybody likes to talk about with regard to the rule of law, the problems associated with establishing the rule of law. I could have spent this whole talk talking about problems, so I'm going to cherry pick a few. The first one is definitely prejudice, at least based on my experience, which is entirely, by the way, secondhand. Right? I've never deployed to work on these projects. I've probably talked to more people who have deployed and come back than practically anybody else with regard to these projects over the years, but I haven't done it. But the consistent theme that you see throughout are problems of prejudice. Some of them are totally, I want to say objective as opposed to normative. Most nations don't have common law systems, for instance. Most nations operate under a civil law system, which has a completely different sort of foundational paradigm. They really look at the law differently and look at lawmaking institutions completely differently than common law nations do. And simply making that switch is hard for most folks who deploy, at least from the United States, to consider. Just major, major differences in criminal procedure, for instance, and sort of the importation of Western sensibilities, both as to the substance of law and the formalities of law. So one of the projects, I lauded it when I saw it, a very popular project last year, not so much this year, was the establishment of defense clinics. We've got lots of detainees who are in camps and prisons in both Iraq and Afghanistan, much more so in Iraq, I think. We want to get these people through the legal system. But you got to give them defense lawyers, right? You can't have a legal system without defense lawyers. Well, it turns out in the Iraqi criminal justice system, defense lawyers don't do very much in the early parts of procedure. And that's common in a lot of civil law systems. But defense lawyers, they're a necessary component, but they don't have the same kind of central role that they have in an adversarial system like ours. And so putting a lot of resources into establishing these defense clinics could have made better use of those, doing things that were more closely oriented to the inquisitorial system that they had. And also prejudice with regard to things like compliance with law. You know, especially in the United States, we have a very rigid conception of what it takes to comply with law and the type of institutions that one needs in order to comply with law. That just doesn't fit a lot of cultural sensibilities elsewhere. Another huge problem is the focus on security. Because these operations happen in the context of a military intervention, naturally the most important thing for the external force, for the intervening force, is to establish security in the environment. And as a result, there's a huge focus on rule of law projects that establish security to the detriment of other projects. It's hard to argue with them, but it does tend to drive towards it a term people were using a while ago, and some still are, is sort of courts, cops, and corrections mentality of the rule of law. That the rule of law is all about the criminal justice system, and once we get the criminal justice system going, we're fine. And that might be what we're interested in as an intervener, because we want that security for ourselves and for the population so we can leave, but in fact, that's a relatively limited understanding of what the rule of law is about, and will cause you, I think, to miss out on a lot of the legitimacy of the legal system. Then there are more practical U.S.-specific problems with how we're approaching rule of law programs overseas. Does anybody know who the lead United States government agency is with regard to establishing the rule of law in foreign countries right now? Any guesses? Yeah, I'm not going to ask you guys. The United States Agency for International Development. USAID is the agreed upon agency, at least among executive agencies. So the State Department actually has the lead with regard to development projects generally. And the State Department and the Department of Defense and USAID have entered into agreement among the agencies that AID actually is supposed to have the lead in rule of law programs. That simply is not, as a practical matter, the case. The Department of State, which has the overall responsibility for development, is incapable of operating in environments where security is not guaranteed, and frankly, just does not have an operational focus. The institutional culture is one that's oriented towards diplomacy and foreign service officers, and they just don't have a very strong operational focus. And so, for instance, the Department of State folks, they wound up actually looking to the Department of Justice to supply their rule of law coordinators in a lot of places. They rely on a lot of temporary employees. They rely on a lot of contractors. But there aren't a lot of civil service or foreign service type Department of State folks who are out there doing rule of law or development generally, for that matter, in these environments, even though State is the lead agency for development and AID is technically the lead agency for rule of law, although they are largely absent in this environment. There is, nevertheless, because of this, right, because State officially has the lead, well, State both officially has the lead, and who do you think is the number one agency sort of cheering State on and having the lead, right? The DOD. DOD doesn't want the lead, and understandably, DOD has a long culture of avoiding nation-building operations as being sort of unending and unwinnable. And so DOD has not done very much to build a capacity to perform this operation either. So what you have right now between civilians and military is civilians stepping up and saying, look, you military folks, we have the lead in this. You guys should not be doing this. And the military folks going, that's right. You have the lead in this. We shouldn't be doing this. And then in a deployed environment, there are no civilians, and there are really a limited number of military folks who, because they don't have a culture, an institutional culture of doing this mission, even though they now actually have an obligation to do this mission, don't have the training to do it, which is why you see things like a rule of law handbook written by the Judge Advocate General's Corps. Right? The Judge Advocate General's Corps has taken the lead largely because they've been put in the lead by commanders out in the field because they simply don't have anybody else to turn to, which leads to another problem, which is the mill problem. There actually is an agency within the military that's supposed to take the lead for these things, to the extent the military does take the lead, and it's the United States Civil Affairs Community, a set of an organization that's designed specifically to engage the civil authorities of host nations to do this types of development work. For a variety of reasons, sort of a combination of decisions, partly a concern over being involved in nation building, and partly a concern over engaging in intervention without political support, the Army put all of those assets into the reserves. And although I am a reservist and proud of being a reservist, it's impossible to build a strong institutional operational culture that way. And so the civil affairs folks who are supposed to have the military lead are also incapable and understaffed and untrained to do this. And so again, you wind up with commanders who are in the field who receive a directive from above saying, we need to establish the rule of law in your province. And the commander thinks, law? Well, I have a lawyer. Right? And they will turn to their judge advocate and say, look, you need to take the lead. This doesn't happen everywhere, but it, especially early in the campaigns, happened a lot of places. You need to take the lead in helping me establish the rule of law. Judge advocates are lawyers and counselors. They're not trained to be operators. They're not trained to plan projects. They're not trained to carry out projects. They're certainly not trained to engage local judges. They're not trained to do any of this stuff. They're trained to provide legal advice to their commanders. And so there's a huge gap there, again, between what our training tells us we should be doing and what we're sort of required to do. So we take judge advocates who are staff officers and put them in operational positions, and so you wind up having to come up with the training after the fact, which is obviously problematic. There's a conflict between operations and capacity building. So one problem with imposing the rule of law, or one problem with establishing the rule of law, is it severely limits commanders' discretion with regard to the ability to carry out military operations. I want you to imagine an invasion, right? You got everything that you need for an invasion, all the stuff, all the weapons, all the troops, right? Everything you need, right? But you add one extra element, which is a search warrant, right? You can't operate without a search warrant. We'll impose that one restriction on a military commander. Not going to go very well, but establishing the rule of law requires that the state itself, the government itself, comply with the rule of law. And so that's exactly what we're asking commanders to do. And in fact, that's what commanders have to do in Iraq now. And I don't think there are no search warrants in Afghanistan, I know of. But in Iraq, right, if you want to carry out an operation, I mean, anymore we've really moved this to the Iraqis, you need a search warrant, or you need some kind of a warrant, or an arrest warrant anyway, if not a search warrant. So we're requiring a lot more engagement with the local justice system. At the same time, military commanders are in fact operating what look like legal systems. So detention operations, for instance. I was really surprised, major shock for me a couple years ago, I saw a great presentation from somebody on rule of law, and I found out that he was the rule of law coordinator for Task Force 134. Task Force 134 is an operation, or was an operation, that operated the U.S. detention facilities in Iraq. I thought, what does a detention facility need a rule of law coordinator for? They're just doing detention, right? They're just keeping people. But in fact, they viewed what they were doing as part of the rule of law program, because they were taking people off the streets, they were trying to process them, hold them or not, punish them, put them back on the streets, and they were essentially operating their own legal system. So unlike civilian agencies that engage in this, the military folks are not only trying to build capacity in host nation institutions, they're often running their own legal systems at the same time. And I think probably what is the largest problem are bureaucratic hurdles within the U.S. government itself. And what I mean by that is not only sort of the problem among the agencies figuring out who's doing what or whatever, but because we're a huge bureaucracy, we have this insatiable need for metrics to figure out what we should be doing and whether or not we're doing it. But when you pick a metric, that necessarily drives the program that you have in mind. So some of the early initiatives, for instance, a lot of them were building courthouses. Right, really tangible, or buying computers for judges. That's a real winner. I must have heard 20 stories about buying computers for judges, right? The judges all want computers. Winds up being a status symbol for the judge. There's a little problem that they don't actually have electricity at the courthouse, right? So totally useless, but you can go back to your commander, your commander's commander, and say, look, we put 500 computers on judges' desks in our province, or in our wherever. 500 is a huge number for province, but and it gives you a number, it gives you a metric, and those metrics are driven by the fact that we've got to be able to report all over our bureaucracy, but it takes away a lot of the fluid discretion that people need in conducting these programs. So how do you conduct rule of law, or how have we conducted rule of law? Not lawmaking. Very little of what we do in rule of law actually involves helping host nations come up with laws, right? I mean, to some extent, a lot of host nations already have laws. Even those that don't, it's just not much effort required to come up with laws, right? You get a few sort of whiz kids who sit down and decide that they're going to come up with a constitution, and they do it, and it's done. It just doesn't take a lot of effort. It often winds up being the biggest failure. So there's really no better way to fail at rule of law than to help a host nation write laws. Again, stories sort of throughout history about these grand failures that you get in helping them write laws. We just don't tend to do that very much, fortunately. And even when we do, it doesn't take a lot of effort. What you do a lot of institutional improvements, like I was talking about before, things like building courthouses, providing computers, stuff like that. There's always the temptation to do that. You always do it early. I mean, you can't have a legal system without courthouses, right? So you show up and there are no courthouses. Pretty easy to do. Training programs, both for judges who, in many countries, are illiterate or, in some cases, just not trained lawyers. Certainly for police, who are usually even less trained than the judges or corrections officials. You know, some are fantastically successful, some are not that successful. All of them, again, are driven by the metrics, right? We put X number of police officers through training, and we put X number of judges through training, easy to report. Mostly it depends on the environment. What you do depends on the environment. Advisory approaches, really interesting advisory approaches, hanging out with people, talking to them. But sometimes more forceful than that. So one advisory approach, for instance, one of our judge advocates did is they went through and there were problems. There are huge problems in correction systems in these countries. There were before we got there. There will after we leave, but particularly bad now. One way to do that, one approach to it, is not to try to build one, but simply to hold the locals accountable for what they're doing. And so this judge advocate went through and just interviewed every detainee in every detention facility in the province that he was working in. And so he had a record of that person and could go to the officials that they were working with. So what's going on with this guy? What's happening? Right? Not force, but simply a matter of sort of informal accountability. Public awareness campaigns. Again, we had some folks who took advantage of the popularity of a local Iraqi sitcom and had them come and put on a program, a live program with a rule of law theme. Things like that. You get posters, comic books, you hear about things like that, attempts to change the culture. But more and more you see what I call chai rule of law, just a matter of sitting down and talking. And not only sitting down and talking and spending a lot of time with judges, but getting the judges to actually talk to the local police commander. That's what people are actually doing now. We started out when we showed up several years ago, doing lots of institutional improvements and then sort of setting up training programs and moving into advisory approaches. But anymore, you see, it's really a matter of relationship building, because so much of what the rule of law is, it's a process, it's a relationship as much as it is an outcome. How else do you do rule of law? You can buy rule of law, right? You can sort of buy security. One particularly successful approach in Iraq, or at least short-term successful, was to hire insurgents, former insurgents, to serve as local security officers. The Sons of Iraq was at least temporarily, I think still probably viewed, largely a successful program. Nobody knows what you do with them after a while. It's a really informal system. The plan was to usher them all into the Iraqi security forces, but there are political reasons, both political reasons and frankly just as a matter of qualifications, there are problems with doing that. So not clear that it's a long-term solution, and you have a lot of compromises in executing the solution. So, for instance, if the former insurgent is wanted by the current government, but you need them as a security leader, do you have to compromise on whether or not the government gets to prosecute them? it's sort of, I mean, I think the larger point is that it's evolving. I like to use so these are our handbooks, right? We've had three of them, 2007, 2008, 2009. You see sort of the evolution of how we were approaching rule of law. This handbook we designed specifically to be courts, cops, and corrections. That really, you just kind of get sort of basic security down, take it easy. Then we sort of expanded to, well, we get the host nation do it, and we have Americans in the background with the host nation in the foreground doing it. And now we've evolved to the point where there are no Americans in this picture. It really is the host nation that's doing so much more of it. And that's kind of the way that programs evolve. You try to have less and less intervention over time. I think another big question is sort of what is success with regard to rule of law? Is it the establishment of a great legal system? Here we have Harman Kazai, who was quite popular in 2002, 2003, 2004. This is Harman Kazai and Abdullah Abdullah. Just this morning, Harman Kazai accepted the finding of the international community that his election had been rigged, essentially, and he no longer had a majority, and so there's going to be a runoff. I actually view this as a success. I'm from Chicago, so election fraud doesn't bother me very much. The fact that Kazai would actually accept the outside finding that it was a problem strikes me as a victory for the rule of law. President Obama agrees with me, so I'm going to stick with that. President Obama said this morning that the Afghan constitution and laws are strengthened by President Karzai's decision without too much regard for President Karzai's previous cheating in the votes. Success is really whatever we call it. It's either a just society, it might be democracy. We talked a lot about going in and liberating the Iraqi people, for instance, back in 2003. Might be the sowing the seeds of international human rights norms. I know that for the Department of Defense anyway, success is the conditions for redeployment, right? Success is being able to leave, to end the intervention. And if that's what your view of success is, that's going to affect sort of what you think the rule of law is about and and the approach that you take to the rule of law. So that's all I have. A little bit longer than I had hoped, but I'm not perfect at pacing these things, as anybody who's taken one of my classes would already know. So just questions about it or not. Yeah, Brian.
Is there a legitimacy problem when an intervening force imposes a certain rule of law?
Well, I mean, it's a huge problem. It sort of depends on who you ask at some level. So the group that you're backing might not think it's a problem at all, right? The other group might have a serious problem with it. And, of course, the international community might as well. I mean, one of the things that I thought, just before I even got involved with this, when we entered Afghanistan, we went in and we sort of said, okay, well, look, you know, we're going to set up a yurga, right? We're going to get a loya yurga. And we'll just get this council of elders, and they'll help us figure out this problem. And I was going, council of elders? What is that all about, right? If anybody told me that, if we were in a similar situation, and somebody said, well, look, you know, we got to reestablish the law in the United States, we're going to get a council of elders together, right? I mean, I would have entered the insurgency at that moment. So that seemed very odd to me, but that actually seemed, you know, it was actually a relatively legitimate, I think as far as the Afghans were concerned, was as legitimate as anything, certainly far more legitimate than the NATO countries getting together and deciding, you know, what the Afghan constitution should look like. So, you know, legitimacy, I think, it's fun to harp on legitimacy because you need to harp on legitimacy in order to sort of get it across to people and get them to stop thinking about more limited views. But legitimacy is a totally contingent point itself, right? I mean, I'm terrified that somebody's going to say to me in one of these talks, and I'm sure it won't be today, okay, well, look, you want legitimacy. What's the definition of legitimacy? They go, that's a little bit harder, right? I mean, if you look at, you know, one of the points that we make in the handbook is there's just no checklist, because everything that you do with this is so incredibly contingent on where you are, what the state of the intervention is, what the country is, what the people want. I mean, look at the differences between Iraq and Afghanistan. They're not that far apart, right? Completely different environments. Actually, right, the populations aren't that different in terms of size, but you look at population densities, you look at their preferences, and of course religious preferences and things like that, previous legal systems. There's so little that I can tell you about that would translate from one environment to another. It's just sort of you have to be incredibly flexible.
You talked at length about the mismatch between the individuals who've been placed in operational roles and the kind of training they've received. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what kind of training program might prepare individuals who have been put into these operational roles, who will be put in these operational roles, that would better prepare them for doing this kind of rule of law work on the ground.
That's a great question. Because my thinking on that has evolved over time. So when I first started doing this a few years ago, I thought, well, the first thing you need to do is teach them about the civil law, and then teach them about the legal system of the country that they're going to. And by the way, it would be helpful if they actually spoke the language, right? And now I'm not so sure about that at all. Now I think it has a lot more to do with teaching people how to work together. That, in fact, so much of this is outreach and being able to identify who the important players are in a particular place. You know, I actually think an MBA is probably better training for this than the JD. You know, you've got to have some legal background. So you sort of see people on two opposite camps, right? Thinking, oh, well, this is law. You've got to have lawyers doing it. And people saying, you don't need a lawyer for this at all, right? All you really need is sort of a smart, flexible person to go out and do it. And I think that legal development is different enough from other types of infrastructure that it really is good to have a lawyer there, that lawyers are better talking to judges than non-lawyers, all things being equal, even if they're from different legal systems. Frankly, they just relate. They can talk about, you know, their experiences in a way, and even the differences between them, that I think it's good. But mostly I think it's about building relationships and being able to make those connections. And so, I don't know, relationship building, I don't recall the relationship part of building part of class during my officer basic course, but that's not a major Army skill. But it's not clear that anybody really has it. I mean, I think everybody is learning this as they go. AID definitely has a huge advantage here in one sense, in that AID does a much, much better job of engaging locals when they actually perform their projects. So when AID goes to a country, everybody talks about how much better the food is at the AID dining facility in Iraq than it is anywhere else, right? Because AID, they didn't bring in KBR or they hired locals, right? And they run a local dining facility, and the food apparently, you know, there's a big payoff there. So that approach is clearly the right approach. It also makes sense from a counterinsurgency standpoint in that you keep people working so they don't join the insurgency. But in terms of specific training, I mean, I think that is sort of much, there's a huge operational problem. You have to teach people how to run projects, basically, and doing that in kind of a culturally sensitive way. But I don't know the school that teaches that. Maybe the Batten School will teach that. That'd be nice.
Are there any historical examples of success? Japan, post-war, the Philippines in the early 20th century?
I don't know if I would count the Philippines insurgency as a success. I mean,
I don't know anything about it.
Oh, yeah, no. So, I mean, you know, it just goes to your definition of success. I mean, I think of Japan as a success. It's not clear how responsible we were for that. You know, I think that their society made a decision that they've since internalized about the role of Japan in international relations. People talk about Europe, right? Western Europe, you could probably look at as being a success. But if you look at the level of effort and the cultural similarities between the occupiers and the occupied, you know, I think it was a success, but it's so far beyond anything that we would consider doing today that I'm not sure how helpful it is as a model. You know, a former colleague of mine here, Rosa Brooks, wrote a book about called Can Might Make Rights. It's a great book. In which she basically says, no, you can't do it. And I'm reading this book going, reading the book getting ready to do my work in this field. And I'm just going, okay, oh, wait a second. I can't do this. So she points to East Timor. Says, you can have incredibly limited success. If you have a really, really narrow scope, then maybe you can succeed in that. But that's just not an option for the folks who find themselves in this situation in the case of a military intervention. I wish I could be more hopeful. Yeah.
Is there a role for civilian lawyers to play in countries like Afghanistan?
I mean, that's the idea, right? The idea is that hopefully civilian lawyers will play a much, much bigger role than military lawyers. I mean, a lot of folks, a lot of civilians argue that the military is just institutionally incapable of doing this because, for two reasons. One is most of the folks in the military aren't lawyers, right? They're soldiers, and they show up and they act like soldiers, and it's inconsistent with a lot of concepts of, first of all, autonomy in the host nation in law, generally. The other problem is even for the lawyers, they're walking around in uniform, they're young, they're inexperienced. In a lot of places, like for instance in Iraq and Afghanistan, right, age means a lot. And so showing up with, you know, somebody as young as these fellows, they're a little young to be walking around talking to judges and suggesting, hey, you know, you should think about different ways about doing rule of law. So definitely, I mean, I think there's a huge role for civilians. The problem is it tends to be security, that civilians have a hard time with that. But I think everywhere, even in Afghanistan now, right, we're getting civilians in the PRTs and the reconstruction teams that are out in the provinces, and really everybody wants to get civilians in as soon as they possibly can. It's not clear to me, frankly, that civilian lawyers are any better trained for this than military lawyers. In fact, military lawyers have a huge advantage, which is that they actually live in an organization that is all about projects. Before I was in the reserves, I had no idea. You think the Army's about guns? The Army's not about guns. The Army's about projects. They just do stuff. They'll do anything you ask them to do. They're amazing. And military lawyers live in that environment. So if you're going to ask anybody to sort of undertake a project, any lawyer to undertake a project, there's nobody better than a military lawyer. But I think that they face, I think, some cultural obstacles to do it. And they don't have, and they're just not trained to do it. So I wish I could say I thought civilians were better trained, but I'm not sure that they are. So, yeah.
Is there knowledge to do follow-up on the projects, or is there just more of a focus to just finish it and leave and do metrics?
Oh, yeah. Definitely, the latter. One of the more encouraging developments, and it's a development with regard to counterinsurgency generally, is to have folks, and this is the way the special forces groups work, folks, the groups actually have a geographic focus. And so people will deploy to an area, and it's domestically politically untenable to keep people deployed for too long a time. But short time is a real problem for doing these kinds of projects. People will deploy, they'll come back, and they'll redeploy to the same area. And so they can build some institutional history with a specific area. But otherwise, another huge problem, right, with rule of law in particular is you show up, we're there for a year, we're gone, right? And you just can't do these kinds of projects. You can't build relationships in that kind of time frame. So the deployment cycle is a major problem, and it leads to the problem that you were talking about, which is you go, you do a project, you report the metric, and then you get out of Dodge, and then nobody pays attention over the long term. It's getting better. I mean, we're learning. You know, we're ignorant, but we're not stupid, right? We're figuring it out as we go. We just didn't know what to do at the beginning. So things are getting better. Yeah, Nalashi?
Who is required to read the handbook?
Who's required to read the handbook? I don't know, gentlemen. Who's required to read the handbook? Nobody's required to read the handbook. They just, folks who, I don't know, people ask for it all the time. I'm not sure how many people actually read the handbook, right? The cover looks great. I don't know if you guys have seen other Army pubs, but this is the best cover of any Army publication I've ever seen. People love the cover. So a lot of people ask for it. I'm sure we give away, for every one that goes downrange, I'll bet you we give away at least 10. Right, people have them in their offices in the States. You know, part of the problem is a lot of judge advocates don't know that they're doing rule of law. So rule of law is not like a slot on an organizational chart in an Army brigade. And so people don't know that they're doing rule of law before they get there. And then they sort of say, what can I do? And then we try to send them this. But there's a course at the JAG school in it. It's an elective. There are actually two courses. They're both electives. And we supply the book, but it hasn't yet been incorporated. Is it in the basic course yet?
No,
it's not. So there. So most the course that all judge advocates take when they go in from the JAG Corps, it's not in there yet. And I'm not sure that it. It probably should be as a matter of awareness, but so few people actually do it, right? I mean, you know, Army lawyers, most of what they do, military justice, contract law, administrative law, they do these other substantive areas or advising on operational law. This has actually wound up being organizationally a subset of our international and operational law departments. So even though, like I said, there really is not much law here, it does happen operationally, though, I guess, so that makes sense. But nobody's actually, and there's no doctrine. I mean, this is really, there's some doctrine now, but it's very minor. It's informal. So I was a little surprised they were willing to do a handbook on it. I mean, because there was no real authority for it, the Judge Advocate General, I think, said, we got to get something. And to everybody's credit, they did an incredible job bringing together folks from a whole bunch of different agencies to help work on the handbook. I mean, the handbook is edited by us, but it's got contributions from practically just from a whole alphabet suit of agencies. Certainly a huge contribution from state and AID and the Department of Justice, the folks who are really involved in doing this outside of DOD. So, sir.
Within your scheme, what is the role of contractors, and what is the interface with non-governmental organizations?
So those are both great questions. I mean, contractors, it depends, again, it just depends on the theater, it depends on where you are. Contractors are doing a lot of this work because the civilian agencies and the military agencies, for that matter, don't have it in-house. I don't think the military is engaging contractors nearly as much. They'll just repurpose a soldier, right, and say, hey, it turns out you're a rule of law expert. And the civilians are less comfortable doing that. So there are a lot of contractors out there. Some of them are great, people who have a lot of experience, who can bring that experience to bear just operating legal systems like judges and things like that. But some of them are not great. I don't know if there's a real feeling about the difference between temporary State Department employees and contractors. That's probably something I should look at, but there are a lot of them. NGOs are hard. There are a lot of non-governmental organizations out there who are interested in this. The military does not have a long history of successfully engaging the NGO community, and I think a lot of commanders are hesitant to do so, partly because it's very hard to both engage them and retain any degree of control over what they're going to do. And when you're a commander, a huge part of what you're going to do, what you need to do, is just to have control over the environment. So I think that they're wary of doing so. I wish I could say that the civilians were better at engaging NGOs. Everybody says we need to do it. It's acknowledged widely that it'd be good to engage NGOs. But I don't think that anybody's really totally successfully engaged a lot of NGOs. What you will see, actually, are some homegrown NGOs. You see bar associations, things like that, and people will key on those and bring them in. And there are some international NGOs, but I don't think it's widespread. They have a similar problem with civilians. Most of them don't operate in environments where the security situation isn't fairly stable. Yeah. Anybody who needs to leave to go to class or whatever, please feel. I'm used to people walking out in the middle of my class anyway, so.
What do you think about the proposed surge into Afghanistan? Do you think that will be, in terms of if it is, say, 40,000 more troops are sent, do you think that will significantly improve the rule of law situation, or do you think there are other differences that would be holding Afghanistan back culturally or developmentally?
No, I'm really not speaking for the DOD. As an intelligent matter, I have no clue whatsoever. As a law professor, right, as a person who's, I think of my job as teaching clear thinking, right? So my concern about the surge is, it worked in Iraq, let's do it in Afghanistan. And I don't think that there's any particular reason to think that the two environments pose similar problems. I think that you can be pretty confident in a couple things, which is sending fewer troops is probably not going to help establish the rule of law. Sort of the counterterrorism strategy that the Vice President's been talking about, I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad strategy. It could be a fantastic strategy. But it's not, I think, a rule of law strategy. And I don't think surges are really... they're good for security, but I'm not sure that they're how great they are for establishing the rule of law, because it takes such a long time to do this stuff. So, you know, I don't. My only view towards the surge is my view towards everything, which is skepticism. I found that to be a pretty successful approach, and so I'm skeptical of it as an attempt to recreate something that hadn't that happened in Iraq. I mean, a lot of people don't think that the surge in Iraq really had much to do with the improvement of the security situation there. A lot of people point to things like the Sons of Iraq as being a much much more important, having a much much more important impact on the security situation. And in terms of the rule of law in Iraq, I don't know how much effect the surge had on the rule of law, other than to help with the security situation. So, other questions? Questions that I might be qualified to answer? Questions about contract or constitutional law? No. Thanks very much. Thanks again to the J.P. Moore Society. Thanks for coming back.